Hello and welcome to the podcast that is canceling the apocalypse, Film Bookcast, the official podcast of filmbook.com. My name is Mike Smith. Joining me, as always, is a man named after his favorite fictional character and his second favorite Chinese restaurant in Brooklyn.
Mike Tacrescio.
How are you doing today, Mike?
I'm doing well, and we're not going to tell you which one is which.
Right. I'm assuming your fictional character is Mike TV from Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, and Tacrescio comes from, Wang Tacrescio in Brooklyn. If you've never listened to Film Bookcast before, first we start with some film news and then move on into some discussions where Mike and I each discuss whatever piece of media we have been consuming lately. And then after that, we move on into our featured review. This week, we are discussing the new film from director Stephen S. DeKnight and the sequel to Guillermo del Toro's Pacific Rim. It is Pacific Rim Uprising. Mike, are you excited to dig into monsters fighting robots and robits fighting monsters?
I am. It's stuff I live for.
Yeah, this is basically like our entire reason for existence. This is why this podcast has come into being in the first place, is to talk about this sequel to Pacific Rim that came out 5 years too late. but before we get into that, Mike, we gotta get into some film news.
Hi, it's time for...
All right, it's time for some film news here on Film Bookcast, and we got some pretty major Marvel news coming down the pike, Mike. As always, we got to start with some Marvel news.
Yeah.
Now, one of the more interesting projects Marvel has going on in the next couple of years is Captain Marvel. They've got Brie Larson signed on to play Captain Marvel. This one takes place in the 90s, and they just announced the cast for this movie. Now, there's already been a couple of names that have already been announced, like Ben Mendelsohn and Jude Law, and now there are some names that are familiar to people who have been fans of Marvel movies in the past. And two of those names are Lee Pace and Jimon Hunzu, who you may remember as Ronan the Accuser and Korvath in Guardians of the Galaxy. Ronan was the villain, and Korvath was kind of like his henchman in that movie. And in addition to those guys, Clark Gregg is back as Agent Phil Coulson. That's huge. That's amazing. I mean, he hasn't been in a Marvel movie since The Avengers, but of course he's been headlining Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. on ABC pretty much since Avengers came out, right?
Right, yeah.
or maybe like a year later or whatever. It was like, and it's been weird. You know, because Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., you don't watch that show, I don't think, right?
No.
Okay, I do. I have not watched the most recent season, but I do watch Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. And, you know, that show takes place, you know, concurrently with the Marvel Universe, and sometimes it, like, intersects with what's going on there. I remember during the first season that it kind of, like, tied in with Winter Soldier in a really cool way and stuff like that. But, you know, one of the big things about it is, like, Phil Coulson died in The Avengers, and Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., he is very much not dead, you know?
Right.
And it's, and a lot of that show is explaining how he came back to life, but also how he can, like, he's, like, still under the radar. Like, you know, nobody in the Avengers knows that he's not dead anymore. And they've just never mentioned him in the movies ever since the Avengers came out. Like, they just never brought him up at all.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's always been, like, a little bit of a weird thing in the Marvel Universe. We're like, hey, Coulson, like, yeah, he's around. But, like, not really.
Yeah. Yeah, we can't cross the TV movie streams. So if he only exists on the TV show, he is dead, basically.
Exactly. It's weird. It's a weird case where, like, the TV show can reference the movies, but the movies cannot reference the TV show. And that makes sense because, like, the people who watch The Avengers are not the people who are watching Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. You know what I mean? Like,
right.
The Avengers is making, you know, $1 billion opening weekend, and Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. struggles to get, like, you know, 2 million views during the week. It's a very different ball game that's going on there. But anyway, since Captain Marvel takes place in the 90s, anything is fair game, basically. Characters who are dead can return in this form. And we already know, like, Samuel Jackson's back as Nick Fury in this movie and stuff like that. So it seems like this will have a pretty heavy S.H.I.E.L.D. presence, but also have a pretty heavy alien presence if, you know, Ronan and Korvath are going to be in the movie as well. And I feel like the fact that they're announcing these guys ahead of time means they're probably more than just, like, a cameo appearance.
Yeah, I mean, I guess maybe Ronan's possibly the villain, I guess. So that would make sense, right?
Maybe. I feel like he might factor into the villain's plot. I feel like I heard that Ben Mendelsohn was playing the villain, but also he just plays the villain in everything. So it's tough, too. It's tough to say. He's the new Mark Strong, basically.
Oh, my God.
Basically what Ben Mendelsohn is doing.
Pretty much.
But, yeah, from what I gather, though, Captain Marvel's going to have to deal with the Skrulls a lot. I think that's going to be a big part of that movie. Mm-hmm. And so I think I've seen a lot of speculation. This could be about the Kree-Skrull War. And since, you know, or the Kree-Skrull War, I guess is what it is. And the Kree, of course, is Ronan's race in Guardians of the Galaxy, so it makes sense that he would be involved in that in some capacity. Mm-hmm. So I'm definitely interested to see what Captain Marvel, you know, has going for it. I'm really interested to see how this movie plays into the final endgame of Infinity War Part 2 or whatever that ends up being called.
Right.
Because that comes out, you know, like 2 or 3 months after Captain Marvel does. And so I think what's going to happen is Captain Marvel, having been set in the 90s, will establish a lot of the stuff that will end up being in play for the big finale of Infinity War Part 2 or whatever it ends up being called.
Yeah, Avengers 4.
Yes, Avengers 4, but Infinity War Part 2 or whatever the fuck.
Yeah. So, yeah.
Marvel 21.
Yeah, no, I'm definitely interested to see how they handle that kind of flashback or prequel, essentially, to whatever's going to be happening. We haven't seen that kind of thing yet in the Marvel movies. And I was thinking about it. I wondered if it was going to be some kind of like universe, not universe reset in like a reboot kind of way, but I mean, Thanos can just like change reality with the gauntlet. So like, I wondered if that was how we end up back in the 90s, which would be insane. But so probably not.
No, I don't think that's how it's going to be. I think this will just be a movie that takes place in the 90s, and that will establish Captain Marvel as a character to be reckoned with, and then she'll show up in Avengers 4 and kick some major ass.
Yeah.
And also establish a couple of other concepts. I think, you know, the fact that the Skrulls are a big part of Captain Marvel, I think they're also going to be a big part of Infinity War Part 4, or Infinity War 4, Avengers 4, whatever the fuck it is. I'll be, okay, I've been drinking a little bit.
Mike, so, it's not the half-assed episode anymore, Mike.
I know. I should have saved it for that one. But, yeah, Avengers 4, Infinity War Part 2, whatever it ends up being called. And Marvel's been pretty cagey about what the movie's going to be called. You know, they originally announced it as Infinity War Part 1 and 2, but they have decided that one's just an untitled Avengers sequel until Infinity War comes out. Right, that's the that's what it is right now. And then because they considered the title of that Avengers 4 a spoiler, so it could be like Secret Invasion, like Avengers Secret Invasion could be a thing,
Captain America's
Secret Wars, the slow demise of Captain America. So I you know, Infinity War comes out in like a month, so I think we're gonna know more about Avengers 4 sooner rather than later.
Yeah,
definitely. But I cannot believe that Infinity War is almost here, man. I really can't. It's actually kind of amazing.
Everyone's. Our dear listeners, begin preparing yourselves for the 3-hour episode. That is our Infinity War review. Start now. Some breathing exercises.
We should just start recording the episode now, and then eventually...
That one just won't stop until it comes out.
we'll take a brief break to go to the theater to go see Infinity War.
Yeah,
and then come back and record the rest
of
the episode.
We won't stop recording. It'll just be 2.5 hours of dead air of us not here.
Yep. It's going to be amazing.
It'll be a podcast first.
But anyway, speaking of Marvel stuff, you know, Marvel Studios has their stuff pretty much locked down. They know what they're doing at Marvel Studios.
Yes.
The folks at Fox, on the other hand, they don't seem to have as firm a grasp as what's going on. So, you know, this year, Mike, 2018, there were supposed to be 3 X-Men movies out, right?
Okay.
There were supposed to be New Mutants. Right. There were supposed to be Deadpool 2. And there was supposed to be X-Men Dark Phoenix. And now... only one of those movies is hitting in 2018.
Whoops.
Yeah, so Deadpool 2 is still set to hit in May. But New Mutants, as you recall, was pushed back a while ago. That was pushed back to February 2019. It has now been pushed back to August 2019.
It's just deleted. They lost the cut. It's over. Game over.
This is amazing. This movie was supposed to be out in 2 weeks.
Yeah.
Like legit, this was mid-April. Yeah. This movie was supposed to be out, and now it is no longer out. And I just like the original thing was like, oh, we want to make it scary or whatever. And now they're saying they want to reshoot like 50% of the movie. They're adding like 2 or 3 new characters in there. It sounds like shit's going bad on the New Mutants camp, and that's a bummer for sure. Because the trailer made me pretty interested. Like I was kind of excited to see what New Mutants had to offer.
Yeah,
you know, because it was marketed as a horror movie, and it was kind of interesting. Like it was different from the other X-Men stuff. But in addition to that, X-Men Dark Phoenix, the fourth movie in the prequel X-Men's, I guess, is how it is. I don't know. There's so many X-Men movies and so many different timelines in the X-Men movies, but the fourth prequel X-Men movie, this one takes place in the 90s, and this would kind of redo the Dark Phoenix storyline, which X-Men 3 kind of bungled. That's supposed to come out in November, and it was pushed to February 2019, so not as big of a delay. Because New Mutants has legit been delayed by like a year and a half at this point.
Yeah, over a year.
You know, X-Men Dark Phoenix is like a 4-month delay. And that could be for any number of reasons. You know, I think part of that is, you know, February has become quite a lucrative month for blockbuster movies. Deadpool hit pretty big in February. John Wick, Get Out, and just recently Black Panther. So X-Men Dark Phoenix, I think, could be chasing some of that Black Panther money. For sure. I don't think it'll make nearly as much money as Black Panther did.
I'm going to go on a limb and say no.
I feel like audiences are not clamoring for the second run of the Jean Grey storyline.
Yeah.
But you know what? Who knows? Who knows, man?
Maybe.
You know, Disney's buying Fox, supposedly. And so, you know, maybe they'll throw in a Chadwick Boseman cameo and they'll add, like, you know, $100 million to the grosses. Who knows what could happen between now and then. But yeah, X-Men Dark Phoenix, supposed to come out this year, now in February. But the New Mutants delay, man, that really gets to me. Because that movie seemed like it could be really cool.
Yeah.
And like it still could be. Like, I'm not saying it won't be, but I'm saying this is a bad sign.
Yeah, this complete lack of confidence or whatever they're doing with the studio makes me a little bit nervous. I was definitely hyped to see, like, a Insane Asylum horror movie that's also an X-Men movie. At least that's what the trailer made it look like.
Right.
So, like, I was in, but I guess I'm not.
Yeah, I mean, if you're hyped to see an Insane Asylum X-Men movie, Legion is on TV right now, and it's great.
That's a good point.
So definitely check that out. Actually, season two of that show premieres like next week. So you have time to catch up on season one. I'm just saying. Like,
all right.
You know, go do it. It's great. But anyway, also, other adaptation news. Gina Rodriguez, who I was just really impressed by recently in Annihilation, but she's best known for her role in Jane the Virgin on the CW. She has been cast as Carmen Sandiego in a live-action Netflix movie based on Where in the World is Carmen Sandiego? And I'm bringing this up because it's a pretty slow news week, but also because I am very much obsessed with the rockapella theme song from the Where in the World is Carmen Sandiego video game show they used to air on like PBS or something.
Well, she sneaks around the world from Vienna to Carolina. She's a sticky-fingered filcher from Berlin down to Belize. She'll take you for a ride on a slow boat to China. Tell me, where in the world is
Carmen Sandiego?
I don't know if you're familiar with that theme song, but it's great.
Yeah. I've heard it before.
Okay, good. So yeah, I mean, do you think this is good casting for Carmen Sandiego, Mike? I mean, I don't think this is like a, you know, a role that has a lot of depth to it at this point, but it could, you know.
You know, I'm not really up on my Carmen Sandiego lore.
Oh, you couldn't tell me where in the world Carmen Sandiego is?
I think, as far as I'm sure, that was the whole premise. Is that no one could.
You know. Yeah, you know what I want out of this? This is completely irrelevant to basically anyone except for me and like a very select group of people who listen to this podcast. But there's a character on Comedy Bang Bang, the podcast, played by comedian Carl Tart, where he plays Chief from Carmen Sandiego, and it's the funniest thing of all time. So I'm hoping
he gets cast as Chief.
What I'm hoping is that this inspires more Comedy Bang Bang bits as Carl with Carl Tart as Chief, because I think he's only done it like 5 or 6 times, and I want him to do it way more. Like I would like it if he did it every week on the show. It's I think it is legit maybe the funniest thing Comedy Bang Bang has ever done.
She was chilling looking for this motherfucker Carmen Sandiego. She ain't been found her, but guess what? I knew where she was.
You know where Carmen Sandiego is?
Hell yeah.
That's ridiculous that she won't tell me.
Hey, you won't tell her?
Nah.
But I enjoy it. It keeps the magic. If I find where she is immediately, I won't be able to have a business anymore.
That's right.
My whole business model is surrounded by finding Carmen Sandiego.
What about Rockapella?
Do it!
Do it, Rockapella.
Did you check from Kiev to Carolina?
Yes.
Okay, that's all.
Because she sneaks around the world from Kiev to Carolina.
Chief, I have a question about your business model. Who is paying you to find Carmen Sandiego?
Nobody. The fever in my own heart. I lust after those milky white breasts.
Yeah, that's one thing that we found out last time you were on the show. You're somewhat obsessed.
Chief trying to fuck Carmen Sandiego.
Shut up, Queef.
Maybe that's why she's in hiding.
Yeah. My name is not Queef, it's Bone Queef. I told you this bone like I ain't got a jealous bone in my body and Queef like a pussy fart.
I barely know who you are.
We are sisters.
Wow. Because
that's saying a lot.
It's him as Chief, who is like, you know, this 60-year-old woman who is just obsessed with catching Carmen Sandiego. But it's like a weird, like, sexual fetish for her. And it's really funny. And he speaks in like this high pitched voice. And it's like, Carmen Sandiego, stuck on the island of Pora Pora. And it's the funniest thing of all time. People should go check out those episodes of Comedy Bang Bang. But anyway, yeah, so Gina Rodriguez playing Carmen Sandiego for Netflix.
You sure.
Know, pretty wild.
That's
pretty
cool.
Wild stuff. I think Netflix is also producing like an animated Carmen Sandiego TV series.
Yeah, well, I think she's voicing Gina Rodriguez is voicing Carmen Sandiego in an animated movie, I think, before the show or
okay.
All the way around, or something like that.
Something along those lines. The point is Netflix is in the Carmen Sandiego business. And,
and business is booming.
Exactly. If you thought they were committed to 1990s revivals before,
yeah,
you have not seen them with Where in the World's Carmen Sandiego yet. So definitely, that's something to keep an eye out for because Gina Rodriguez is pretty good. And she was really great in Annihilation. So I'm excited to see what she does next. And then finally, I got one last bit of film news here, Mike. And this is probably the most exciting news that I could possibly ask for. A little while back, I think maybe like 2 or 3 episodes ago, we talked about the new Men in Black reboot that is in the works, directed by F. Gary Gray, the guy who made Fate of the Furious and Straight Outta Compton.
Right.
And we did not have any actors to be in that reboot at that point. There was nothing announced yet. Now we know the 2 stars who are going to be in this Men in Black reboot. And hold on to your butts, because this is a pretty amazing casting choice. Chris Hemsworth and Tessa Thompson are going to be the new Men in Black.
Fuck yeah, they are.
It's a Thor fucking Ragnarok reunion up in this bitch.
So I'm saying that I want to be on the team. Has it got a name?
It's called the Revengers.
The Revengers?
Because I'm getting revenge. You're getting revenge. And you want revenge?
I'm undecided.
And Men in Black headquarters, and I cannot wait. Like I was tentative about like a Men in Black, you know, spinoff, reboot, whatever it is, without Will Smith and Tommy Lee Jones.
Yeah.
But if you get these two together, like this is pretty awesome. I mean, because Chris Hemsworth can be fantastic as the goofy kind of Will Smith role, you know, in this movie, and Tessa Thompson can be great as like the stern straight man Tommy Lee Jones type role. Like I think they would play off together so well in Thor Ragnarok, and I'm really excited to see what they can bring to something as, you know, batshit insane as Men in Black, where it's just, you know, 2 people fighting aliens and stuff like that, which has this like comedic tone throughout. You know, that it's awesome. I think it's perfect casting.
Yeah, I am super pumped for this now. This is the thing I didn't know I needed in my life, and now I have it, and it's great.
And I don't even know what to do with it. Yeah. It's coming soon. I think it's coming like next year. Like they're planning on releasing this. So it's coming down pretty soon. I think Tessa Thompson's also going to be in Infinity War, actually, as Valkyrie.
Yeah.
Yeah, literally every character from every movie will be in Infinity War. But Tessa Thompson as Valkyrie, pretty cool. Pretty cool stuff. She hasn't been in any of the posters or anything like that, so I don't think she'll have like a major role in the movie. But, you know, still cool. Yeah. I am excited to see what she does. And she's been blowing up the past couple of years, too. I mean, she was in Annihilation as well.
Yeah.
Now that I'm thinking about it. But she was also in Westworld. And, of course, she was in Creed. This year, she'll be in Creed 2. So, yeah, Tessa Thompson blowing up. And Chris Hemsworth, I feel like, has fully embraced his, like, comedic side recently.
Yeah.
And so I'm very excited to see what he can do in a Men in Black sequel/reboot. I think I would bet money that Will Smith and Tommy Lee Jones will make a cameo in this movie.
I kind of hope Tommy Lee Jones is like Rip Torn's character, like the chief guy, like the head.
Yeah, I could see that. I mean, it's been a while since I've seen the Men in Blacks. I remember the first one ended with Tommy Lee Jones' retirement, and then the second one kind of brought him back.
Yeah.
So I think he was still in it by the end of Men in Black 3, but I don't remember exactly. I remember Rip Torn died in Men in Black 3, or his character
No,
died.
That was real life, like, Mike.
They actually killed Rip Torn off screen. Just,
oh my god!
Just, you know, add realism to the scene, because Men in Black is all about the realism,
real method, you know.
So I could totally see Tommy Lee Jones taking over the Rip Torn role. Honestly, I could see Will Smith taking over the Rip Torn. Yeah. I think it'd be more interesting if Will Smith was in the Rip Torn role than Tommy Lee Jones. Tommy Lee Jones, you would expect right, to be in that role.
They're going to zig when we thought they were going to zag.
Yeah, I think it would be way more interesting if Will Smith did it. Otherwise, yeah, Chris Hemsworth, Tessa Thompson, Men in Black, like, I'm down. That's great. My only request is that Chris Hemsworth gets to do his own rap. That's all I care about.
It's a prerequisite, I'm sure.
Yeah, the movie irrelevant. I need a new music video. Because I don't know if you know this, Mike, but I know Will Smith's Men in Black rap by heart. That is in my brain.
Wow.
Right there. And it's something that I'm semi-proud of. Like, I'm semi-ashamed, semi-proud.
It's just part of who you are, Mike.
It's just part of who I am, exactly. So I would love to hear a new Chris Hemsworth version of that rap. That's all I'm saying. But anyway, I think we can wrap up film news, Mike. Let's move on into our discussions. Watch this.
These are my discussions. Just when I thought I said all I could say, my buddy and I talk about movies we see.
These are my discussions.
There is so much to see, you and me. So we're gonna talk about movies for our discussions.
All right, now it's time for our discussions here on Film Bookcast. Mike, what do you have to discuss with us today?
Today, I only have one movie. Life's still a struggle for me right now, so I don't have a whole ton of free time.
Yeah.
But I had approximately 73 minutes of free time, Mike. And in those 73 minutes, I watched 1932's Vampire? Vampire?
V-A-M-P-Y-R, right?
Yes.
That's how it's spelled?
That is how it's spelled.
I believe that's Vampire.
Vampire. Indubitably. But this is a movie directed by Carl Theodore Dreyer,
who's
probably most well-known or for making the 1928, I think, silent movie, The Passion of Joan of Arc.
Right, and I recently watched that movie, actually, The Passion of Joan of Arc. It's very good.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy. But this Vampire is – I watched kind of just on a hunch. It was on Filmstruck, so it's available to stream on Filmstruck, the Criterion Collection version of it. And it's got a really – like awesome evocative cover. Like all the Criterion movies, I think, do have this awesome art all the time.
As
the box art kind of thing. And this is just a silhouette of a guy holding a giant scythe. And I was like, I'm in. Let's watch whatever this is about. And as you can guess, it is about a vampire movie. It's this weird thing. It takes place like in the French countryside, where this guy who is an occult enthusiast goes to this small town and has these weird visions, and in its 1932 like Danish, German, French horror world, it's very, very fucking creepy. It's just like 73 minutes of nightmare, and in that like weird experimental, we don't know what film is yet kind of way, sort of thing. So like, they're doing lots of weird camera tricks and like shadows and playing, you know, sequences backwards kind of stuff. Sort of reminded me of some David Lynch things, which is neat.
Nice.
And it is a sound film, but it is mostly silent. You know, there is dialogue and stuff like that, but that just adds to the fucking creepiness of one of the main characters literally follows a man shadow through town, like just the shadow for like 20 minutes, and it's wild, doing some creepy shit. So if you're down to watch, you know, some 1930s German horror, Vampire is a good one to go with.
Cool. All right. Yeah, that's Vampire. It's available on Filmstruck right now.
Yes.
I have not seen Vampire, but I would definitely like to. It's a silent film, right? I don't know if you mentioned that.
It has sound. There is dialogue, and you know, but there it's mostly it's like what's jazz singer sort of thing, right? Where like there is dialogue and sound and stuff, but most of it is still silent. Like in that sense, you know, there's title cards. I looked up the Wikipedia afterwards, where because they had to record the movie in three different languages, I think it's Dutch, German, and French or something like that. They were like, this is hard, let's just mostly not talk. So they just decided to make it mostly silent.
Interesting. So I'm a big fan of that era, like that transitional era between silent and sound.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's a lot of like really interesting sound, like kind of hybrid movies.
Yeah,
between the silent and sound era. Like one of my favorite movies of all time is Modern Times, the Charlie Chaplin movie.
Yeah.
Which is amazing, and that's like, you know, a mostly silent movie, but it has like bits of sound in it. It's actually one of the only movies where Charlie Chaplin actually speaks. Or he sings in it anyway. And it's a really engaging, really interesting movie. So, and a lot of that is from just the way it kind of uses you know, silent cinema tropes, but also adds in, like, you know, this new technology at the time, the sound technology. It's really cool.
Yeah, there's one weird complaint, or something I thought was, I don't know if interesting is the right word, but, you know, there's subtitles, right, for the dialogue and stuff. And since most of it is, you know, it's this weird hybrid thing, but a lot of the story is just told through title cards. But they're like giant paragraph long title cards because they have to explain the occult and vampires and weird shit. So that, and then just like white subtitles over that text. It's like you're trying to read subtitles in between the text of this giant paragraph. I don't, it's weird. But okay. if you can deal with that, Mike, I suggest, I recommend Vampyr.
Okay, yeah, that's Vampyr, available on Filmstruck. And then I have a few movies I want to talk about today, some more recent stuff here. The first one is called Before I Wake.
You've heard this before. Your son doesn't want to sleep.
That little boy's dreams come true. It's an amazing, beautiful thing. What are his nightmares?
Dangerous.
Deadly.
Have you heard of this movie, Mike?
I feel like I've heard the title, but I don't think I know anything about it.
Okay, well, this is directed by Mike Flanagan. It's a Netflix original, and this was actually shot a couple of years ago. It was supposed to come out in like 2015, 2016, something like that. And the studio just sat on it. Like, it just never came out for various different reasons. Like, it was supposed to come out, and then it didn't, or the studio went bankrupt or something. I don't really even know exactly what happened. But anyway, this movie kind of languished for a couple of years, and it ends up being released internationally in 2017 by Netflix. And then Netflix finally released it in the U.S. in January of this year. And this is Mike Flanagan, who's the director of this movie. He has directed a bunch of really great horror movies that I have really loved. I've championed his work on this podcast a lot. He directed Hush. He directed Ouija 2, which fucks so hard, man. That's a great movie. and he directed didn't do Year Next. That's Adam Wingard.
Right.
A different horror director that I've been championing on this podcast.
There's just so many, it's hard to keep up.
It's just so many, I know. But he did a Gerald's Game, also the Stephen King adaptation on Netflix. He's done a lot of Netflix originals. And Before I Wake is, I guess, considered the latest one. This one stars Kate Bosworth and Thomas Jane as a couple who has their child recently passed away. He's like a very young kid. And they end up taking in this other young kid as like foster parents. And this new young kid is played by Jacob Tremblay. Ooh. And here's the thing about Jacob Tremblay's character, Mike. When he sleeps, his dreams kind of enter the real world. Whoa. But also like demons from those dreams start happening too. It's horror stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
What were you gonna say?
It's like a reverse Freddy Krueger.
Yeah, honestly, yes. I actually had that same thought when I was watching it. It's like, oh, it's reverse Nightmare on Elm Street. Yeah. And I will say, I think the first half of this movie is pretty solid. Like, there's some interesting stuff going on. I think the second half really takes a nosedive. I was not as into this movie as I was hoping I would be, which is a shame. I am a big fan of Mike Flanagan. I mean, Hush and Ouija 2 and Gerald's Game is like an amazing triple pack of movies. He also did Oculus a couple years ago, which I think I've talked about before on this podcast. It's a movie that I watched shortly after it came out, but I don't remember any of because I was pretty hammered when I watched it. anyway, so Before I Wake, I would say if you're a fan of Mike Flanagan's other work, check it out. It is somewhat interesting, and I think there are some sequences that are pretty good. I think Jacob Tremblay is really annoying in the movie. You know, I think most kid actors are annoying, like, most of the time. So there's that. But, like, Thomas Jane as the father is pretty good. Kate Bosworth as the mother is pretty good. You know, it's interesting. Like, Kate Bosworth is a little bit older now, and she could, like, believably play mothers and stuff like that. I remember, like, back in, like, 2006, she was in Superman Returns as Lois Lane.
That's right.
And she was, like, 21 when that movie came out, and it was ridiculous.
She's younger than Superman.
Well, because that movie was, you know, supposed to take place, like, it was supposed to be in the same continuity as the first two Superman movies, but it was supposed to take place like 5 years later or something. And so it was like this weird case where, like, Lois Lane, who's supposed to have like in that movie, she has like a 6 or 7 year old kid in Superman Returns. And Kate Bosworth was like 21, 22. So she would have had that kid when she was like 15. Which is not impossible, but it's definitely odd to put in your Superman Returns movie. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's cool to see Kate Bosworth in these roles that she can, like, believably play them now. You know what I mean?
You know, just good for Kate Bosworth, you know?
Good for Kate Bosworth. You know, I feel like I don't see her that much anymore, and I like her, so I would like to see more of her. But anyway, yeah, so that's Before I Wake, directed by Mike Flanagan, is available on Netflix right now. It's all right. I mean, there's some decent scares in it, but it really takes a nosedive in the second half, and I think the ending is, like, legit terrible. But I also saw Red Sparrow recently, Mike.
Ooh.
From this day forward, you will become sparrows. Weapons in a global struggle for power. Every human being is a puzzle of need. You must learn to intuit what is missing, become the missing piece, and they will give you anything.
Yeah, this movie is also not very good.
Oh, no.
This is directed by Francis Lawrence. And if you don't know that name, he directed Constantine, which I know you're a big fan of.
Yeah.
And he directed I Am Legend, and I think he's more well-known at this point for directing The Hunger Games 2, 3, and 4, Catching Fire and Mockingjay's Part 1 and 2. And so this movie stars Jennifer Lawrence, who he directed in the Hunger Games movies, as a Soviet spy who is also kind of working with the American government, but she may be double-crossing them. Like, who knows what's going to happen, you know?
Twisty turny.
Yeah, and so this is a spy thriller starring Jennifer Lawrence. And, you know, I was kind of intrigued by this movie, by the trailers. I thought it looked pretty stylish and pretty cool, and I'm a fan of a good spy thriller. I think Red Sparrow is okay. It's not great. There are some really solid sequences. I think the opening sequence is pretty cool. You know, it's weird. I think you know, it's a movie that's I completely blanked where I was going with that, but
that's how okay it was.
It's so okay. You know, it's a movie where Jennifer Lawrence plays a ballet dancer at the beginning, who breaks her leg, and like that whole sequence is fantastic. But then like the rest of the movie happens, and like she ends up being involved in the Russian government and being sent away to become a Red Sparrow, this like seductive secret agent. And so she basically like even the movie calls it it's whore school. In wow. The movie. And so it's a very sexualized movie, and it's, you know, one that I think is sometimes interesting and sometimes engaging, but other times just like really like there's a sense it's like, well, what are we doing here? Like, what's the point of this? It's often confusing. Like, I think spy thrillers are often kind of confusing, but this one's like more so. And you know, it doesn't really work as a whole. There are like decent scenes throughout. I think Jennifer Lawrence is pretty good in it, but overall didn't do that much for me. And Joel Edgerton's fine in it. Like, there's solid actors throughout. Jeremy Irons is in it, so like that's cool. Mary Louise Parker from Weeds, like she's in it. Like, you know, there's people in this movie, and they do good work. But you know, I think Red Sparrow just falls pretty flat. I think compared to something like Atomic Blonde, which I saw last year, and that's a movie that is much more engaging, at least on an action level, because the action in Atomic Blonde is fantastic. Like, there's so many great set pieces in that movie, and Red Sparrow just doesn't have that. And that's fine. Like, it doesn't, but it doesn't need to be, you know, Atomic Blonde. It could be something more like Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, but it's not nearly as engaging as Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy. So,
there you go.
Know. Anyway, that is Red Sparrow, directed by Francis Lawrence, out in theaters right now. And now I want to talk about a movie that I saw recently, and it's called Unsane, Mike.
I'm so jealous.
Yes. Hi, my name is Sawyer Valentini. I am at Highland Creek Behavioral Health Facility. I am being held here against my will. Please send help. Thank you. I'll be out of here in like 20 minutes.
Do you know how many calls the cops get like that every week?
Those are from crazy people.
Yeah, I'm surprised you didn't go see this. We were talking about like doing this podcast, and I was like, well, I'm going to go see both Pacific Rim and Unsane this weekend. And, you know, you can choose whichever one you want to see, and then we'll review that movie. And you decided to choose Pacific Rim, so we're going to review that. But I really wish you had chosen Unsane. Spoilers for my thoughts on Pacific Rim, too. But
I haven't seen Unsane, but I'm going to say same.
Yeah, so Unsane is the new movie directed by Steven Soderbergh, who's a director who I'm a big fan of.
Friend of the show.
Yeah, friend of the show, Steven Soderbergh. You know, most recently he returned from retirement with his movie Logan Lucky, which came out last year, which we both loved, made my top 10 list last year. And Steven Soderbergh is a guy who is always like constantly experimenting. I feel like especially recently in his career. I haven't watched it yet, but he did Mosaic on HBO, which aired in like January, which is like a 6-part TV series. That was the choose your own adventure type show that he did. So you could watch it via your app if you wanted to. Like you can watch it on your phone or whatever, and just, like you kind of choose how you wanted the story to play out. But HBO released like a 6-part miniseries that was just like a more straightforward version of that story. So I haven't watched it yet. I'm going to check it out at some point. But anyway, so he has been experimenting a lot recently in his career. And Unsane is a movie that he shot in secret while he was making Logan Lucky. And he shot it secretly on his iPhone, in fact. It's on his iPhone 7 Plus, I believe. And this stars Claire Foy, Jay Farrow, and Juno Temple in this movie. And it's about a woman who is involuntarily committed to a mental asylum. And she may actually have cause to be there, but she may not. And it's like you're wondering back – like she's also like – being stalked by this guy who she sort of dated like once upon a time, but not really. And this guy's just obsessed with her. And when she's there, she starts seeing visions of the guy. And she's not sure if she's going insane or not, like that, stuff like that. It's a pretty cool psychological thriller. And I wasn't sure if I was on this movie's wavelength for a while. Like for the first hour, I was like, okay, this is interesting. Like I'm engaged, but I'm not sure where this is going. And then that last like 40 minutes kicks in. And this movie just gets nuts, like real fast, and it's real good, man. It's real good, you know. And it takes some twists, takes some turns, you know. It does all those things. I think what most impressed me is that the iPhone cinematography in this movie is actually it's used pretty effectively as like a sort of claustrophobic almost. Like it makes you feel like you're very close to the action. In this movie. And I don't think this would work for every movie, you know. I know Soderbergh is actually, his next movie is also shot on an iPhone. And like he recently posted on Twitter, like, you know, oh, 3 hours after I finished filming, the rough cut's done. Like, he's like already finished editing because he's a fucking beast. But, you know, but that's not like a thriller like this one is. So I don't know how that one's going to play out. But this one, though, like when the movie started, like you can tell immediately this is not shot in conventional camera. This is shot in like, you know, an iPhone. It almost has like the fisheye lens and like it's very close up. And it just looks like very digital and like it looks like un-cinema like.
You almost said it.
What was I going to say?
The name of the movie.
Oh, Unsane. It looks very unsane. It looks very uncinema like, I guess, is what I'm saying. It doesn't really look like a movie. It looks like something that like somebody would post on YouTube.
Because it is
right, kind of because that's how it's supposed to look. But it is, you know, that feeling kind of dissipates over time, and you kind of get used to the look of the movie, and it becomes, he's using this iPhone to get shots that he would not otherwise be able to get, and so he's like constantly figuring out new ways to like to innovate with this. With this technology, and I think that's pretty cool. So Unsane, definitely worth checking out. Also, I want to just throw out there that you know, the first thing I heard about Unsane, like when I first heard about this movie, like the first article I saw was that, you know, Steven Soderbergh shot a movie in secret on his iPhone with Juno Temple. So all I knew about this movie going in was that it was shot on an iPhone and that Juno Temple was in it. And then when the movie ended, I was like, wait, where was Juno Temple? Like I had no idea. I had no idea where she was, and it turned out she had like a very prominent supporting role in the movie. She is just unrecognizable. Like I had no idea that it was her. And she's great. Like she's fantastic in the movie. And you know, I mean, I've seen Juno Temple in a lot of things. Like I watched her on Vinyl. I saw her in Dark Knight Rises. She was in a couple other things. I think I've seen her like. She was in Year One with Michael Cera and Jack Black. Yep, I saw that movie in theaters, and I remember Juno Temple in that movie. So I have, you know, seen Juno Temple in a lot of things. That was like almost 10 years ago. So I've seen Juno Temple in a lot of things, and I had no idea that was her. and Unsane. So she is fantastic in this movie. But also Claire Foy as the lead of this movie is great. She's awesome. And it feels very perfectly timed for the hashtag MeToo movement and all the stuff going on in Hollywood right now. I think there's really interesting stuff going on in Unsane. Also, Jay Farrow, who used to be on SNL, is no longer anymore, but he's in this movie and he provides some really cool moments and funny moments as well. So that's Unsane, directed by Steven Soderbergh. Well worth checking out. It's really cool. And then finally, Mike, I want to talk about the movie that fucking rocked my socks off recently.
Okay.
I've been meaning to watch this for a while. Like I was regrettably not able to watch this before 2017 was over. But it's available on Amazon Prime right now. And this is the new movie directed by S. Craig Zahler, the guy who made Bone Tomahawk a couple of years ago. Mm-hmm. I am talking about Brawl in Cell Block 99.
Every once in a while, I see a man in that chair who could just as easily be on this side of the table.
That muscle's just for show. Helps me lift stuff.
Man, principle.
Relinquish it now.
You know the difference between right or wrong? And you have a moral compass. I knew before you told me that you got an American flag in your home. You probably got more than one. You're a patriot.
Now, have you heard of this movie, Mike?
I have heard of it, but I don't really know anything about it, other than I'm assuming it's a Prison Riot movie.
in a sense, yes. So this is a movie starring Vince Vaughn as this guy who goes to prison for sort of noble reasons. Like he's a guy who gets involved with crime and he understands that. But the only reason he goes to prison is because he kind of intentionally botches this heist, you know, because these guys that he's working with are like shooting at cops and like they're like destroying. So he shoots the guys that he's working with, but he ends up getting like, you know, the rap for it. Mm-hmm. So he ends up going to prison. And this movie is a pretty amazing throwback to exploitation grindhouse movies of the 70s, you know, every kind of prison movie that you can think of. And it's a long buildup to get to all that stuff. But even that buildup just feels so perfect. Vince Vaughn is amazing in this movie. Just flat out. He is doing career best work. Wow. In Brawl in Cell Block 99. I mean, you know, he is somebody who in general has this very like laid back, like cool guy persona. You know, he's in Swingers, Dodgeball, and Wedding Crashers. That's kind of his thing. And you know, every once in a while he kind of breaks out of that. You know, he broke out of that in like True Detective season 2, right? Like he was in that show. And you know, it's like I remember when True Detective season 2 was coming out, the thing that most excited me about that season was that Vince Vaughn was in it.
Yeah.
Because I was like, how could Vince Vaughn possibly, like, how could the Vince Vaughn that I know be in True Detective? And he was pretty good in True Detective. Like, but it was just, you know, that season was terrible. Yeah. But he is like fantastic in this movie. He is so brutally physical in a way that I was flabbergasted by. Like he's a true action star in this movie, but it's not really an action movie. It's a weird way to describe it, but this movie is so brutal, and like you feel every crunch of bone that happens in this movie. Like the sound design of this movie is impeccable. I will say that. But yeah, honestly, like watching this movie and seeing it on Amazon Prime, I think this might be my favorite movie of 2017.
Wow.
Like it is straight up that good. It was unbelievable. The fight scenes in this movie are a sight to behold. Like I think this is really like, it's not really an action movie, so to speak, but like the action scenes feel like this is Vince Vaughn's John Wick, you know, like this.
Holy shit. Okay.
And you know, the buildup to it is so good and it's such a fucked up movie. You know, I really don't want to spoil some of the stuff that happens in this movie because it is so intense and crazy. But Udo Kier is in this movie as well. Don Johnson is in this movie and Jennifer Carpenter. And there's so many great actors are in this movie. And like, just the basic premise of this movie. Like when you actually figure out, like when you find out why Vince Vaughn is doing the things he's doing to get to where he is, it's like, oh, that's fucked up. And like, like just the reveal of that, it's insane. So Brawl in Cell Block 99, this is pr- probably my favorite movie of 2017. Like, if I had seen this a couple months ago, it would have been my number one for my 2017 list. It is a truly remarkable movie. Vince Vaughn's amazing. S. Craig Zahler, I think, is a director who I am very excited to see what he does next. I really enjoy Bone Tomahawk, but I think Brawl in Cell Block 99 is just like another level of filmmaking prowess that he has in him.
That's awesome. I think depending on how long we go, I might watch that after we finish recording. Because that sounds dope.
Yes, definitely. All right. So I think that wraps up our discussions, Mike. Let's move on into our featured review of Pacific Rim Uprising.
We were born into a world at war. Between the monsters that destroyed our cities and the monsters we created to stop them. We thought we had sacrificed enough. But the war we thought we finished is just beginning. And the only thing standing in front of the apocalypse is us.
All right, that was from the trailer for Pacific Rim Uprising, the new movie written by Emily Carmichael, Keira Snyder, Stephen S. DeKnight, and T.S. Nowlin, and directed by Stephen S. DeKnight. This stars John Boyega, Scott Eastwood, Jing Tiang, Kaylee Spaney, Rinko Kikuchi, Bern Gorman, and Charlie Day, among others. And the IMDb plot synopsis for Pacific Rim Uprising reads, Jake Pentecost, son of Stacker Pentecost, reunites with Mako Mori to lead a new generation of Jaeger pilots, including rival Lambert and 15-year-old hacker Amara, against a new kaiju threat. And I think that plot synopsis is semi-misleading, because part of it is saying he reunites with Mako Mori. She's in like 5 minutes of the movie.
Yeah. yep.
Yeah, so Pacific Rim Uprising, Mike. I mean, this is the sequel to Guillermo del Toro's Pacific Rim from 2013, which I think is a movie we're both, you know, pretty big fans of, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, so I recently rewatched it, the original, before I saw Uprising. And, you know, I will say, I think that is a very fun movie. I hadn't seen it in a few years, so I think it's still a very fun movie. I do think it loses something when you're not watching it on the biggest screen possible. Right. That, like, when I saw that in theaters, like, I was blown away by it. Like, I had so much fun with it. I remember watching Pacific Rim and seeing that moment where the Jaeger is dragging, like, an oil tanker down the street.
Yeah.
And it has the electric guitar, like, blaring in the background. And I thought that was the coolest thing of all time. Watching it, like, at home on my TV, like, it was during the daytime, like, it was, by myself, like, it wasn't even with my friends or anything, like, it was still fun, I had fun with it, there's a lot of good stuff in that movie, but I think its flaws are more apparent when you're not watching it just, like, on the biggest screen with the loudest speakers, of all time. You know, Guillermo del Toro is a guy who I'm a huge fan of, you know, he's made, like, since Pacific Rim has come out, he's made two movies, which seems unprecedented for him.
He actually made movies.
He's made two movies, and not only that, he's become, you know, a respected Academy Award-winning director.
Yes.
He just recently won Best Director for The Shape of Water and, won Best Picture for that movie as well. So Guillermo del Toro was planning on making this movie. He was originally writing Pacific Rim 2 himself, and I think the idea was that he would direct it, and ended up not doing it, I think because he was doing Shape of Water. And so, you know, obviously that worked out for him.
Yeah, but, good for him, you know?
Talking a little bit about your feelings about Pacific Rim, like your thoughts on that movie and how they kind of, like, correspond with your thoughts on Pacific Rim Uprising.
Yeah, so I should have watched Pacific Rim before this, just because I think that's always a good idea in these kind of circumstance where it's been, like, I don't know, 97 years between movies. How long has it been?
It's been 5 years.
5 years between movies. I feel like we've been talking about Pacific Rim 2 forever.
I think there was a recurring joke on this podcast for a while, and it's been, like, in a little while since we've done this. But, like, I think we were talking about how, like, Pacific Rim 2 would never happen. Like, because updates about it would happen in, like, film news and stuff like that, and we would talk about it during that time. And we were just like, oh, Pacific Rim 2 is not going to happen. Like, that's ridiculous. Like, because the thing is, this movie, the Pacific Rim 1 did not make a ton of money in the U.S. Right? It was kind of considered a not a bomb, but, like, not a hit by any means. Mm-hmm. But it made enough money overseas where the studio was like, okay, well, maybe we can do something with this, you know?
Right. I remember he did like a Twitter thing for it, or maybe that was Hellboy.
I think that was Hellboy, where he was like, right? I'll meet up with like Ron Perlman and stuff like that, and we'll see if we can make like Hellboy 3 happen.
Yeah.
Kind of thing. And Twitter was like, yeah, like, fuck yes, do that. Do that, please.
Yeah, it was like he did like a Twitter poll. It was like, would you want this to happen? Yeah.
And obviously, yes, we want that to happen. And that's not going to happen either because he's, you know, they're doing the Hellboy reboot now without Del Toro. And, yeah. So it's a bummer.
It is. But anyway, I really enjoy Pacific Rim, or at least in my memory of it. I remember it's kind of the same thing you were saying. It's this big, insane, silly, fun, spectacle, fluorescent, just popcorn movie. And it promised robots fighting monsters. And it delivered on that in the fucking coolest way, like you said.
Yeah.
He uses an oil tanker as a sword. Like, what?
Yes.
Or a bat, I guess.
It was a bat, yes.
It was more of a bat. So I have a lot of fondness for that, their affinity for that movie, right? And Pacific Rim 2, or Pacific Rim Uprising, there was something about it that didn't get me as jazzed as I was for Pacific Rim. Like, when that first one came out, I was, like, hyped about it. And for some reason, I don't know if it was the marketing or whatever, I wasn't that excited to see it. But it still, in theory, promised robots fighting monsters in cool ways. And, like, that's a pretty low baseline to get me to see a movie. So,
yeah.
Like, I was in. I was still kind of in. That said, though, Pacific Rim Uprising is just missing something. And I can't figure out what it is, whether it's Guillermo del Toro's just, like, plucky love for whatever he's doing, where he just is going to make the most genuine robots fighting monsters movie you can get, and that's Pacific Rim. Pacific Rim Uprising is, I bet we can make money with this again. And it kind of like reeks of that to me in some way.
Yes.
And like there's that quick little montage in the very beginning where we're introduced to John Boyega's character, Jake Pentecost.
Yes. Which, by the way, like Stacker Pentecost, that's a name.
That's a fucking name. Yeah.
Jake Pentecost is like, what, you forget how to make names? Like,
I mean, yeah, it's not the same guy anymore. You forgot the guy with all the creativity's gone. And it's kind of just like Edgar Wright's hot right now. Let's make this like quick cut montage of him saying words while he's holding the thing that he said. Like, it's just, I don't know. It just seemed like it cashes in on a lot of stuff. It felt like to me.
Yeah. I will say, I mean, I talked about this, you know, a few months back, but I was at the New York Comic Con panel for Pacific Rim Uprising, where they debuted the first trailer for this movie. And the vibe in that room was like, yeah, people were kind of excited about a new Pacific Rim. Like, obviously, like, they were there for that panel, so they were excited for it. But it felt like – I remember – like, I think I talked about this in the podcast where we recapped Comic-Con. We watched that first trailer for the movie, and I remember thinking, like, you know, this looks like it could be fun. But also, like, it feels like a pretender to Del Toro's throne almost, you know? Like, it feels like, you know, it's somebody imitating something I loved but not quite replicating it the way I remembered it being, you know? So that said, like, robots do go smash in this movie.
A lot.
Monsters go smash in this movie, too. Although the monster – I feel like this movie's kind of light on the monster elements. Like, they show up at the end. You know,
maybe let's save it for spoilers, I guess.
Sure, but they don't really show until like later on in the movie, and it's kind of robots fighting robots for a while.
Yeah, we kind of get Godzilla'd, or the new Godzilla, where it's like, remember Godzilla? He'll be in the last 44 minutes of this movie.
True, but I liked Godzilla more than I liked.
Oh yeah, that's definitely true.
But yeah, I think this just kind of like lacks the world building and the craft of the original movie. You know, part of what I love about that original Pacific Rim is it really quickly sets up this world. And you know, I think most directors, when forming something like Pacific Rim, would probably start it at the beginning, right? They would be like, "Oh, monsters have just shown up; we have to fight them right now," kind of thing.
Yeah.
Whereas Pacific Rim takes place like 10 years after a monster war, right? So it's like it starts off like with this like, you know, voiceover by Charlie Hunnam. And, you know, to be fair, Charlie Hunnam is not great in that movie. He is the blankest of blank slates. Or at least he was the blankest of blank slates until Scott Eastwood showed up in this movie.
He's the Jai Courtney of Del Toro movies.
exactly. And Charlie Hunnam's a fine actor. He's good in other stuff, but like in Pacific Rim, I think he's just kind of a blank slate. But that movie opens up with, you know, this voiceover by Charlie Hunnam, like detailing what has happened, like the exposition voiceover. And I like that voiceover got a lot of flack when that came out. I kind of like it. Like it feels like, you know, the way Charlie Hunnam reads it, it feels like, you know, just swaggering badassness, which is what, you know, that movie is. Like, like Pacific Rim, the original, is just like, you know, swaggering badass nonsense for like 2 hours. And it's pretty awesome. This movie, I feel like, lacks that kind of sense of world building and craft. You know, there's a detour in Pacific Rim into Ron Perlman's underground kaiju black market industry.
Right.
And it's awesome. Like it's just such a cool concept to me that's even in that movie in the first place. And this movie doesn't have anything even remotely close to that. You know, there's no character like Hannibal Chow in Pacific Rim 2. You know what I mean?
Yeah, no, I definitely agree. This movie has a weird turn it takes, and I'm sure we're going to talk about it. but it's not nowhere nearly as interesting as that. As Ron Perlman's character, or it doesn't even try to give us that glimpse into the world. Not that like we necessarily need that, right? I think that's what makes that so important or so awesome about the first Pacific Rim, right? Where we're there to watch kaiju versus Jaeger, right? Robots fighting monsters, and we get, you know, that's why I appreciate that voiceover like you were talking about in the beginning, where it's just we got to get this out of the way so we can get to the thing we're all here for, and they do it in a cool way, in an effective way. But we still get Del Toro is such a just a lovable fucking peach of a man that he I don't know.
I believe when he won Shape of Water for he won Best Director for Shape of Water, you called him a roly-poly happy person.
That was it. Yes, I couldn't remember what I called him. He's such a wonderful roly-poly happy person that he's going to take 6 minutes out of this movie of robots fighting monsters to be the best black market movie ever. Like, he's going to do this crazy shit ever. And it's like, yeah, I'm in for this.
Exactly. And
we don't get that.
No, we don't get that in this movie. And there's so much stuff like that in the first movie. You know, there's like, see, like that movie to me is like everything Del Toro does feels like, you know, like he pours 110% of himself into whatever movie he does. And I think Pacific Rim feels like, you know, every you know, kaiju movie that he's ever loved, everything that Del Toro is just poured into Pacific Rim.
Yeah.
And so you have, like, you know, homage to different monster movies, but you also have, like, homage to different martial arts movies and, like, stuff like that going on. So like, there's like, a sequence in Pacific Rim where, you know, Charlie Hunnam and Rinko Kikuchi are, like, kind of testing each other and, like, doing this, like, that's my favorite sequence where they're like Rinko Kikuchi is like kind of like testing out to be his drift compatible partner, and they're doing like the martial arts like bo staff fight in front of all the other recruits, and it's fantastic, and it's just this awesome hand to hand like combat sequence, and there's nothing like that in this movie. Like
there's somebody put somebody else in a headlock though.
Sure. that definitely exists for sure. I will say, I mean, I think this movie does have its merits. I think, you know, there's some of the action is kind of fun. You know, I think John Boyega is good.
Yeah.
You know, as Jake Pentecost, even though it's a lame name. It's you know, I think John Boyega is channeling a lot of what, you know, like he's able to use his British accent, which is nice.
Mm-hmm.
Because I don't think he's really used it since Attack the Block, and you know, I'm a big fan of Attack the Block, so excited to hear that again. But it kind of feels like he's channeling his Finn from Star Wars a little bit. You know, he's kind of like, you know, being funny throughout the different scenes, and he's like always ready with the wisecrack and stuff like that. But he kind of feels more like roguish in a weird way than like Finn does in Star Wars. You know what I mean? Well, Finn by way of Han Solo, I guess.
By way of Poe, you mean?
By way of Poe. Finn by way of Poe. Yeah, if he was playing Poe Dameron, basically.
This is... I guess. Yeah, don't worry about it.
What were you going to say?
No, that's fine.
Oh, okay. Were you going to make a joke about Finn and Poe?
Finn and Poe, yeah. That's
being right. Lovers?
Yep.
Get your head out of the gutter, Mike.
Never.
But yeah, I think John Boyega is pretty good in the movie. Otherwise, like the other actors, I think Scott Eastwood is, you know, he's Scott Eastwood. It's you know, he's fine, I guess. You know, I still think the best Scott Eastwood role has been The Fate of the Furious, where every character dumps on Scott Eastwood the entire movie.
Yes, you're absolutely right.
That's really the best thing. But you know, I think much like the original Pacific Rim, I think Charlie Day runs away with the movie. You know, I think, you know, Pacific Rim, I do like him more in the first one where he's kind of like channeling Rick Moranis in Ghostbusters. Mm-hmm. But in this movie, I think he's having a lot of fun doing his thing, and that's pretty cool. And also, like we should point out, most of the cast of the original movie is not in Pacific Rim 2. It's really just Charlie Day, Byrne Gorman, and Ringo Kikuchi. And really, it's just Charlie Day and Byrne Gorman. Like, if you really boil it down. And they're good. I think their segments of this movie are the best sequences in the movie.
Yeah.
You know, and they're good. But, like, you know, the original Pacific Rim had such a memorable supporting cast. Like, even though Charlie Hunnam was not great as the lead, you know, I think Ringo Kikuchi was amazing in that movie. Ron Perlman and Charlie Day and Idris Elba. Like, they're all great in Pacific Rim. And this one just does not have that supporting cast to back it up. You know, it has Scott Eastwood and it has a Kaylee Spaney as like this, you know, hotshot young like teenager who gets recruited into the Pacific Rim thing, that who's like kind of paired up with John Boyega. And like, she's fine. Like, I have nothing against her. She kind of reminds me of a young Ellen Page, actually, weirdly enough. But I don't know. It's just it feels like this is the YA adaptation of Pacific Rim almost.
Oh my god, that's the exact. That's the perfect way to put that. Holy shit! You just blew my mind with how everything just clicked into place.
Right, and that feels deliberate, right? That feels like it's absolutely 100% meant to be that. Like,
yes.
It's like the studio is trying to cash in on, like, you know, young people like to see themselves on screen, but also, like, you know, Chinese audiences will enjoy Pacific Rim 2, so let's give them what they want and stuff like that. And so,
yeah,
you know, there is, you know, a lot of the movie is focused on her character and, like, the team of young recruits that are brought into the Pacific Rim fold. And, I can tell you some stuff about her character. I can't tell you anything about any of those other recruits. Like, I think one of them was Russian. Like, that's basically it.
It's basically like Ender's Game meets Pacific Rim 1.
Yeah.
That's actually...
But yeah, any other thoughts about the movie, Mike, before we move into spoilers? Like, any other stuff you want to talk about before we get into that stuff?
Not really. I feel like there's not a ton to say. We kind of.
Yeah, it's
okay. It fulfills the giant stuff, fighting giant stuff. Like you said, it's mostly robots v robots for a lot of it. But you know, it's got some interesting things happening with that in terms of that action, right, going on. But otherwise, it's pretty flat, I think.
Yeah, I would agree. I think it's a relatively flat movie. Like, it's fine. Like, I would say it's like a 2.5 out of 5-star type movie.
Yeah.
To me, like, I enjoyed parts of it, and like, John Boyega is good, and like, there's some fun action. But it doesn't have, like, you know, and even Pacific Rim 1, I think, is like a 3.5 out of 5. Like, it's not, I don't think it's great by any means, but I think it's a really fun movie. And this movie just, it feels like a blander version of it.
Yeah.
You know, like, it feels sanded down in pretty much every area and, like, you know, designed to be marketable. I will say one thing about this movie that I do kind of like, compared to the original, is that, it sets all of its action scenes during the daytime, which, yeah,
that's true.
Which the original Pacific Rim sets all of its action scenes at night and in the rain. So it's almost like
cooler,
but it's kind of hard to like see the action in some of that movie. So it's kind of nice that they, you know, brighten things up a little bit in this movie. But it almost feels like, you know, an episode of Power Rangers compared to like,
oh my God,
compared to like something like, you know, an homage to like old kaiju movies and stuff like that, which, you know, that's fine if it wants to be like an episode of Power Rangers. Like, I think it's okay at being that. It feels like a Saturday morning cartoon, like when you're watching it, like, it really does. And so to that end, I think it's relatively successful if that's what it's trying to be, but, it just wasn't my bag as much as the original Pacific Rim, I guess is all it was. But with that, I think, Mike, we can move into spoilers. So let's do that. Let's move into spoilers for Pacific Rim Uprising starting right now. All right, spoilers for Pacific Rim Uprising starting right now. So, Mike, I want to talk about the thing that bugged me the most in this movie. And I don't know if you agree with me on this, like, we'll see. But they kill off Mako Mori.
Yeah.
After giving her nothing to do for no reason. Nope. Like, there's no reason why they killed her off.
She gets fridged so hard.
Yeah, and, it, like, you know what? Like, fuck that noise. Like, that's...
Yeah.
That is absolutely ridiculous. Like, she is, you know... I think one of the more interesting characters in the original movie. You know, she has so much to do in that movie, and in this movie, she's just kind of like in a suit. She's like talking to John Boyega every once in a while. Like, first of all, John Boyega's character I think is problematic for the reason that like we've never heard, like they never mentioned him once in Pacific Rim 1. Idris Elba never mentioned that he had a son. You know, and Rika Kikuchi never mentioned that she had a half brother. You know,
it's right. Yeah.
Like these are characters who are supposedly decidedly linked to Jean Boyega's character, and they just never brought him up, like, at all.
Yeah, they go to, like, great pains to explain why Idris Elba never talks about him by setting up the, like, he expelled his own son from the pilot program, and he was a huge disappointment and kicked him out onto the streets and, like, disowned him and, like, all this stuff. So, like,
right.
All right, cool. But, like, Miko, like, likes you a lot. Like, you guys, like, you talk about how much your brother and sister all the time. Every scene you're in together.
Right. That's all you talk about, really. Yeah. but, yeah, I think, you know, when she shows – because she's probably only in, like, a couple of scenes in the movie. Like maybe, like, three or four scenes.
Yeah.
Before she gets killed off. And every scene she's in, she's just, like, establishing, like, oh, well, I'm your sister and you're my brother because, you know, Idris Elba raised us both and that kind of thing. And, like, you know, you're a rapscallion, but I think you got potential, kid, and all that stuff. And then she dies.
Yeah.
and like, if she had died for, like, a reason – you know, that might be fine, right? But
yeah.
She doesn't. Like, she just dies. And it's not like, you know, John Boyega needed extra pain to, like, make us sympathize with his character. Because, like, his stab was Idris Elba, and Idris Elba died in the first one. So, like, we already have that connection. Yeah. We already have a family member who is dead. You don't need to kill off Mako Mori. And, like, if you're going to do that, why not just not include her in the movie so you can save her for a later time? Because, like, Charlie Hunnam's not in the movie, and they don't kill him off. You know?
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, and they mentioned his character a couple of times. Like, they mentioned Raleigh Beckett, like, once or twice throughout the movie. They never say what he's doing. But then, like, when Mako Mori dies, like, why isn't he there? You know? Like, why?
Yeah, that's a good point.
That's my question. Like, these people are drifted, man. They have a connection.
But do they, you know? In this movie, that's, like, not even really a thing. No, like...
Right!
They talk about, like, how hard it is to be drift compatible, but that seems like... In this movie, all that means is having the ability to drift. It doesn't matter with who.
Yeah, right. In the first movie, it had to be with a certain person to be drift compatible. It was like a very rare thing.
Yeah.
Type thing. Like, right? It was Charlie Hunnam was drift compatible with his brother in that movie, and then his brother dies in the first 10 minutes, and then he ends up being drift compatible with Rinko Kikuchi, right? And right. So, you know, that's a big deal in the first movie, and I think it's a great concept too. Like, I think the idea of, like, these human minds kind of intertwining to you know, pilot this gigantic, you know, robot beast is very cool. I think it's a really great Del Toro-y concept that is in that movie. And this movie just kind of just like, yeah, everybody can drift.
Yeah.
You know, it's real tough, but you can do it. And, you know, you can pretty much do it with anybody. It's fine.
Yeah, yeah. It's missing all the roly-poly happiness that we want so much.
Exactly. We just wanted some roly-poly happiness from Pacific Rim 2, Mike. That's all we really want. I will say I was pretty into the twist surrounding Charlie Day's character.
Okay, yeah, sure, you could do that.
Were you not as into it?
I was very weirded out by it.
Were you? Okay, so in the first movie, Charlie Day drifts with a kaiju brain. One of the things that, you know, when Del Toro was talking about his plans for Pacific Rim 2 when he was actually going to make it, that was something that he wanted to follow up on, was he wanted to deal with the fallout of what would happen to Charlie Day that he drifted with the kaiju brain. And this movie kind of picks up on that thread too, which, you know, I like. I think, you know, the process of this movie, I think there's a lot of different drafts going on for Pacific Rim 2, and I think it kind of took stuff from every draft. So I could totally see this being taken from at least a little bit from Del Toro's draft. But, you know, so I think there should have been more to it to kind of better establish what was going on. But yeah, so in the beginning of the movie, Charlie Day shows up, and it's cool with Charlie Day, and he's acting like all Charlie Day-ish, and he talks to Jake, and he's like talking about his dad, like, man, your dad was great, he can do a great speech, that stuff about canceling the apocalypse, that was amazing, man. And it was like, yeah. You know, like, okay, yeah, remind us about the best scene in the first movie, just to show us how bad this movie is.
Exactly.
But, you know, he's talking and stuff like that, and he's having a blast. Like, Charlie Day's having a lot of fun in this movie.
Yeah, he definitely is.
And I found that pretty infectious. Like, I enjoy Charlie Day in this movie. But then when he meets up with Bern Gorman, and he's like, oh, you should come over, you can meet Alice and all that stuff. And then later you see Charlie Day in his house, and Alice turns out to be a kaiju brain that he's that he's, like, perpetually drifting with. And I found that pretty entertaining. And then later on in the movie, it turns out Charlie Day is actually, like, a sleeper agent for the kaiju, I guess, at this point. I'm not sure if I think that twist is good in and of itself, but I think the execution of that twist is fantastic. Like, the way Charlie Day plays it is pretty great.
Yeah, I was down with that. I don't know. So at one point, I guess once the review embargo lifted earlier in the week of when this came out, I saw if it was Mike Ryan or Matt Singer, I can't remember which one, tweeted about how weird it is, and like how just an insane movie Pacific Rim Uprising is, and all I saw was Charlie Day's character is married to a kaiju, and I was like, that can't be right. So then there's that scene where I don't remember the character's name or whatever. He says, like, oh, you can finally meet Alice. And I was like, oh, yeah. No. Like, when they say that, I just remember that tweet. And I'm like, oh, my God, is it real? And then there's the scene where he's like, let's have some fun in the bedroom. It is weird, like, Charlie Day cartoon version. It's like, yeah, it's a kaiju brain. Yep. It's married to a kaiju.
Yeah, he drifts in while they're listening to I Want to Know What Love Is by Foreigner. And it's a super weird scene. I was into it.
fair. But I was okay. I liked where the like payoff of that insanity went, where, you know, he's been infected, quote unquote, by the architects or whatever, precursors or whatever the hell they call them.
The precursors, I think is what they call them. Yeah.
Yeah. And they're using him to destroy, like, to foil the human plans and reopen the drifts. No, not the drifts. Whatever. Breaches. There we go. Yeah, so that was fun, I guess. Sure.
Yeah, I mean, I was into it. I think the way he plays it is a lot of fun. Like, he's like bursting into a room and like he's like, don't move, I will shoot you, and like that kind of thing. And like, you know, he's really fun playing that kind of stuff, because I think he doesn't usually have to play, like, you know, menacing. And he's not really doing menacing. He's just kind of doing goofy, but like he's doing menacing things. So I think it's a lot of it's pretty entertaining watching him do that. And then it kind of leads into the big climactic brawl where the monsters fucking finally show up. And
yeah.
Cause that's the thing, that most of this movie is them fighting drone versions of the Jaegers, right? So it's like unpiloted Jaegers.
Yeah.
Or like Jaegers that are being piloted by kaiju brains, discover later on. And like, the robots fighting robots is fun. Like, that's cool. But like, you know, I'm signing up here for the robots fighting monsters, and there's not a lot of monsters in this monster movie here. You know, I feel like Jeff Goldblum in Jurassic Park. You know,
yep.
It's like, you are eventually going to have a kaiju in your kaiju movie, right? Tap tap tap. Yeah. So I think there is a, you know, it does lead into that big climactic monster battle, but I think it just kind of speaks to the way the movie is structured, where it kind of just feels like four disconnected episodes of like a Pacific Rim TV show, just kind of like mashed together.
That is exactly how it feels. It's just it's the giant mega kaiju is just a metaphor for what this movie is, where it's four different drafts put together into one two-hour movie.
Yeah, honestly, so that mega kaiju, right? So there was three kaiju at the end of the movie. Right. They showed up in like the same location. They were all going to attack, like, what was it, Mount Fuji or something?
Mount Fuji, yeah.
And then Charlie Day does something, some kind of science thing or whatever, and merges the three kaiju into one giant kaiju. Right.
Right.
And that's like, at first it's like, oh man, look at that giant kaiju. But I was thinking, like, well, I feel like the job was tougher when there were three kaiju, because now you just have one target instead of three targets.
Now it's got the abilities of all three of them in one.
Right, but like, did they have like distinct abilities? Like, were they just like big monsters?
They're mostly just big monsters.
Right. That's kind of the thing.
The only interesting one was that it like absorbs the energy and throws it back at them. Like, that was kind of cool, I guess, but that was the only distinct like thing.
I'll be honest, I don't remember that. Like, I just straight up do not remember that happening.
That's fair.
I think I just kind of zoned out while that was going on. But I mean, Yeah, so the monsters kind of merge into one gigantic monster. And yeah, it gives them an easier target almost. it gives them a plan to okay, now we can launch ourselves up into space and then shoot ourselves back down and smash it really hard on the head and then it'll die.
Yeah.
And that's basically the end of the movie. They just knock it really hard on the head and then it's gone. Mm-hmm. That's, you know, it feels a little underwhelming almost. Yeah, otherwise, the movie does end with a tease for a sequel, right? Did you not?
I don't remember. I remember the dumb detail about the kaiju, but I don't remember.
It's good that we were selectively paying attention to different parts of the
together, movie. Together, we have a full movie.
The movie ends with Charlie Day strapped to a chair, and John Boyega comes in, and Charlie Day's like, oh, we're going to come back, we're going to get you, and stuff like that. Like, he's still, infected by the kaiju. And John Boyega's like, no, we're coming to you, bruv. And, it's... That's my John Boyega impression. You're welcome.
Pacific Rim 3, Attack the Breach.
The movie kind of sets it up so that Pacific Rim 3, they're actually going to go into the kaiju world.
Right.
Instead of being in the human world. And that, I think, is a really cool idea for a Pacific Rim movie. I wish it was this movie. I kind of wish that was what Pacific Rim 2 was. But it's definitely it could be pretty interesting. So I'm curious, Mike, if you would want to see a Pacific Rim 3. After watching Pacific Rim 2, Del Toro lists and stuff like that, do you think a Pacific Rim 3 is a good idea?
Good idea seems like a strong word.
Okay.
I'm not totally against it, but I just don't really have a desire for it. I feel like it's like a... It's like a Transformer movie now, at that point.
Right. And I Pacific Rim almost feels like... It is Del Toro's answer to Transformers in a weird way, right? It does feel, it's the giant robot movie fighting giant monsters and stuff like that. But this doesn't feel like it's Del Toro's answer to Transformers. It just feels like a Transformers knockoff.
Yes.
And that's fine. I think it is better than the Transformers movies for what that's worth, or at least most of them. I don't think this is as good as the first Transformers movie. I will say that.
Yeah.
Because that first Transformers movie, I haven't seen that movie in a very, very long time, but it's a movie that I did like at the time when it came out. And I think it does still have a strong core relationship between Shia LaBeouf and Bumblebee in that movie that does help it out. This one does tease a sequel, and I would be interested in seeing that sequel because just the idea of it sounds cool. But it's not something I need. And it's not something that I'm sure will happen. This movie, much like the first one, didn't do great, I don't think.
That's true.
It opened at number one, but it was $20 million-ish or whatever. And that was after Black Panther had dominated for 6 weeks in a row.
Yeah.
and it's going to drop this weekend with Ready Player One coming out. And so I just don't know. It could be saved by the worldwide box office again. It could happen.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know. And I just don't know if Stephen S. Knight is the guy to make these Pacific Rim movies. He doesn't have the... I'm not against somebody who's not Del Toro making these movies. I just want somebody who is like Del Toro making these movies. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I agree.
Stephen S. Knight, fine guy. He created Spartacus and Stars, and he was a showrunner on the first season of Daredevil on Netflix. He used to work on Buffy the Vampire Slayer and stuff like that. He worked with Joss Whedon for a bit, and so he's done a lot of TV work. This is his directorial debut. Wow. Uprising, and it's a huge movie for your directorial debut. It's a lot of money to be trusted with. I think he does an all right job, but it just doesn't he's not Del Toro. Guillermo del Toro is in a level up here, and Stephen S. Knight is down here. You know what I mean? This is an audio podcast, but I'm making motions with my hands, and I hope the listeners can follow along with the motions that I'm making.
paint us a word picture, Mike.
So I don't know. Who would you want to see take over Pacific Rim 3, Mike? Is there anybody that jumps to mind? Del Toro would be ideal, but that's not
maybe one of the John Wick guys.
Just give them everything.
I want robot judo, basically, is what I'm saying.
Yeah, David Leitch, who did one of the who co-directed the first John Wick, he is doing Deadpool 2 right now, and the trailer for that recently came out. And the action in that movie looks fucking great. It looks so good. I cannot wait. I think Deadpool 2 is going to kick Deadpool 1's ass.
I hope so.
In the action department, and I'm pretty excited for that. But I don't know who. I'm not sure who I would want to do a Pacific Rim 3. I could see, I talked about him before, Mike Flanagan could probably do a pretty good one.
Friend of the show.
I'm just saying, yeah, friend of the show, Mike Flanagan. Yeah. I'm just saying that I'm looking at the Wikipedia page from Before I Wake right now. But
that's definitely it.
Yeah, but I don't know. I'm not sure if there is a director out there right now who has that just singular. Like, there are tons of directors with singular visions, but I feel like the singular vision that Del Toro has and the specific confluence of influences that Del Toro has in his mind that create Pacific Rim.
Quentin Tarantino's Pacific Rim 3.
Exactly. Like, it just doesn't work, you know? Yeah. Like, that would be insane. I would watch the fuck out of that, but it's not, you know, it's not something that I need. Like, and I'd rather Tarantino be doing his own thing, you know?
Yeah.
Like, and I mean, he is doing his own thing. But I don't know. If Pacific Rim 3 happens, I'll probably see it. But it's not something that I'm actively anticipating, which is kind of how I felt on Pacific Rim 2. Like, once Del Toro was not involved, I was like, well, all right then.
Yeah. Like, I guess this happens.
You know, but the movie definitely delivered on some robots fighting monsters. And for that, you know, I can't fault it. So, all right, Mike, I think that wraps up our thoughts on Pacific Rim Uprising. Where can we find you online this week?
You can find me at twitter.com/mdfilmblog.
All right. You can find me online at twitter.com/msmithfilmblog and all of our podcasts and stuff at filmbook.com. Thank you for listening to FilmbookCast. I'm Mike Smith. That is Mike DiCriccio. If you're listening to this review via our podcast on iTunes, you can subscribe to the podcast, rate it, take a moment to give us a review, and then any and all feedback, compliments, topic discussions, even hate mail can be sent directly to podcast@filmbook.com. Now, please list the podcast you're emailing about in the title of your email, because we produce just so many different ones, hard to keep track. We would love to hear from you. Now join us for the next episode of Film Bookcast, where I think we'll be talking Ready Player One, which I'm seeing tomorrow night and I'm pretty excited about. You know, it's something that you know, I have been like kind of like, you know, on the fence about, because I love Steven Spielberg. Was not a fan of that book.
Yeah.
And so but I, you know, I think the reviews that I've read indicate that, like, I'm probably going to enjoy it. And I think if Spielberg's having fun, then I'm probably having fun, is basically how I feel about the movie.
It's a good pick.
And you can check out our next Complete Works episode, where we're talking Nicolas Cage's role in Werner Herzog's 2009 film, Bad Lieutenant, Port of Call, New Orleans. This will be a fun one, Mike, because we've been stuck doing some kid movies for the last couple episodes.
We have. We're still in 2009, though.
Yeah, well, this is the last one in 2009.
Okay.
This is the last 2009.
All right.
So, yeah, this is going to be a big one, though. This is going to be exciting. So we'll talk about that next episode. Thanks so much for listening, guys. We are out. He was this robot. So very. He's got robot.